We'll call the docket.
Alvin Chariot, an hour against Lawson Realty Corporation, David S. Bailey, Lee Pellis, Herbert P. Kelly, George A. Somerville, Jeffrey C. Keller, P. Appleby.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is David Bailey. I represent the plaintiffs in this case, Alvis Cherry and Ashley Aldridge. If I may, I would like, if there are no questions by the Court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time.
Three
minutes. The yellow light comes on, I will sit down unless you have questions. I will stand here as long as you have questions. Just a brief history of how this case came to you, because it's a little bit interesting. We filed a complaint for personal injury and property damage alleging breaches of contract, breaches of vert law, and common law claims in the trial court. No claims were brought under Section 8.01-226.12. There was extensive argument by before the court, before the trial court, Honorable Judge Fisher, on common law, right up until the pretrial conference day, which was on a Friday before the Monday trial. On that Friday, Judge Fisher, I think, quite frankly, being fed up with all the arguments about the common law, announced that he had reviewed the law and he had reached a conclusion that Section 801-226.12 was the applicable statute in this case and to be applied. Since it was not pled, and his conclusion was it preempted all common law, the judge then struck all the common law claims, leaving us only with a property damage claim and a possibility of amending to include Section 8.01 claims. I immediately asked for an interlocutory appeal, which the judge granted, and you have agreed to hear.
Had your opposing counsel asked for a ruling of that nature? Is that
before? For an interlocutory appeal?
No. No, for a ruling that 8.01 essentially cleared the field.
No, not in the initial briefing. The decision on 8.01 came out of the blue from the bench on the day, the Friday before trial. That's why, and the only reason I bring that up, that's why you have no briefing in this case before the briefs in this court. Judge Fisher had worked on this a lot. He spent a lot of time on it. I don't dispute that at all. He'd made up his mind, and there wasn't much to be said at argument before him.
May I ask you this?
Yes, sir.
On the question of field preemption by the statute or supplanting the common law, exactly what common law basis do you have after Isbell for even asserting a negligence claim?
Well, Isbell only addressed vert law, a Virginia Residential Landlord-Tenant Act. And Isbell said vert law is a contractual relationship between, statutory contractual relationship between the tenant and the landlord. Therefore, only economic damages could be asserted.
But didn't the court explain that under common law principles, there was no generic tort duty to repair the premises that were solely under the occupancy of a tenant? And therefore, if that's true, what is there to preempt here?
Well, the old common law rule, which was extensively argued before Judge Fisher, said that once a tenant takes possession of the unit, the tenant has it, that's it, the landlord has no further duties, unless the landlord comes in and makes repairs, does them negligently. And that's what happened in this case. But as a general rule, if you have a contract, which we had in this case, where the contract says the landlord reserves to him the right to make repairs, then the tenant cannot make such repairs. So if the landlord comes in and makes repairs negligently, then there's that count.
To clarify then, correct me if I'm wrong, you're not asserting that there is in fact a duty to come into the premises and make repairs under common law. You're rather arguing that, well, you don't have the duty, but if you assume it and actually perform it, you have to perform it reasonably.
Yes, and also, unless you have a lease agreement which says the landlord, upon notice from the tenant, will make all repairs.
Well, that would still be a contractual
remedy.
That's
a breach of contract.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be a tort remedy, of course.
It would not be a tort remedy.
Okay, I understand.
That's correct. There are other common law claims, of course. There are failure to warn, there's concealment, there is fraud, all the other kinds of common law that may be available. So,
but fraud has been dropped out of this case, am I right?
Out of this case.
Yeah.
But not in the interpretation
right.
of the statute. So the first thing you have to do, in my opinion, and everyone seems to agree, all the appellants, the amicus brief, everyone, is this code section 8.01-226.12, is it a statute intended to impose liability for personal injury and property damage as a matter of law if there is a violation of VRTLA, the applicable statute? Everyone agrees, yes, that's the case. And if you look at the history of it, following right after Isabel, and the wording of it, it would all certainly appear, it excludes some people, includes others. It appears to be a statute designed to create a statutory cause of action. That's the first premise. That's where we start from. And as I said, everyone agrees to that. Now, once you get there, then you have to look at the context of the wording of the statute to determine, say, for example, if all common law claims are abrogated, complete preemption of the field. Now, that's a hard rule. It's a hard thing for the court to find because common law claims, common law rights are protected in this commonwealth. So we look very hard at the statutory language to see if there is complete preemption of the field and abrogation of all common law claims. Now, when we look at this statute, there are two operative provisions, the two key provisions. One is Section E, which deals with landlords and remote remediation, and one is Section F, which is a general requirement to comply with applicable law, which would be VRTLA. If we look at Section E first, the trial court found that that had actually a very limited application. Judge Fisher held that Section E says only a landlord only has a duty at move-in. If there's mold found at move-in, the landlord must remediate. If he fails to remediate, statutory right to file a cause of action. If the mold occurs later, even if it's because of the negligence of the landlord, the trial court said there's no claim. The landlord's duty is only at the period of move-in. Now, if you look at that statute and give it the same interpretation, that means that the abrogation of common law cannot possibly occur because you have eliminated all other remedies for tenants under common law. You couldn't have negligent repair, for example. You couldn't have any claims under common law. So I think that provision, if it's interpreted to be so limited, then that means the common law can't be abrogated. However, we argue, we're the only ones making that argument, by the way, unfortunately, that Section E is not so limited. Even though it uses the word visible mold, and the trial court found that, well, visible mold is defined in the statute that says visible mold at move-in. Well, unfortunately, visible mold is also a term people would use to describe, what do you see? Visible mold. So in Section E, the General Assembly did not repeat the words at move-in. Instead, they substituted the word occurs. So if visible mold occurs in the rental unit, the landlord has the obligation to clean it. Well, now, that makes sense, because then if visible mold occurs at any time during the tenancy, the landlord has an obligation to make that repair.
So, counsel, I'm a little slow in the uptake. So I'm looking at the definition of visible evidence of mold. Fortunately, it is defined, although it's not really a technical term. It's visible to the naked eye of the landlord or tenant at the time of the move-in inspection.
Correct.
Now, as I said, I'm a little slow on the uptake, but I think of mold as being something where it becomes visible only after it has been present for a period of time. And there are an enormous number of mold spores that would not be visible at any particular time. Did that science ever come into the argument?
First of all, I'm pleased the court is aware of the scientific conditions because that's absolutely right.
It's giving me a little bit more benefit than I deserve. So.
It can be in the walls. It can be under the carpet. It can be any number of places. And it has to grow into a colony, and it's actually what you see as visible mold. It's a colony of hundreds of thousands of mold spores that have grown together.
So how does a statute abrogate the common law as to visible but not invisible mold, and how would a court even be have the ability to draw that line?
I think it would be extremely difficult. And I think where this language comes from, when it's borrowed from Wörtla and got inserted in here, and it can't mean the same things. Under Wörtla, there's a specific clause that says if visible mold is seen at move-in, then the tenant may say, hey, even though I've signed the lease, I want out. It's 5 days, terminate the lease period, no questions asked. But it was really designed to do was just to approach things in common sense manner. Suppose you go into an apartment, for example, and you open the refrigerator door, and there's some mold along the weather strip on the refrigerator door. Common. You see it in your own homes. Or maybe they go into the bathroom in the shower and there's a little bit of mold in the gravel. The idea behind that was if you see that visible mold, the tenant and the landlord can agree, go in, clean it up, it's not a big deal, take care of that. The tenancy then continues. But if there is a problem, if there's mold growing on the walls, if there's mold in the carpet, it's visible mold growing in the unit, the tenant may terminate the lease. That's what those Wörtla provisions were intended to do. So when you incorporate that into this code section and you talk about landlord liability for the entire time, you create a serious problem. Now, I've argued in many cases visible mold at move-in has to be a rebuttable presumption. You, in fact, Justice, don't know whether it's hidden behind the walls. You may not find that out for 6 months when it pops through and grows all over the drywall.
May I take you back to Isabel for a moment? Follow this hypothetical. Let's say there's no statute on point for visible or invisible mold, and we're just dealing with common law. And there's a contractual provision that says whatever it says about the duty or the obligation or the access of the landlord to come into the tenant's leasehold. And mold develops and there's personal injuries. If there was no efforts during the tenancy for the landlord to come in and try to remediate at all, would there be any negligence liability for the mold condition in a personal injury context?
Not under negligent repair.
Okay. But I'm not trying to trap you. Let's just stop there. So am I right, and as it goes back to the first question I asked you, the way your claim survives, if your first thesis is right about the limited preemptive nature of the statute, you still can only get, and I'm wondering how you can prove this, you can still can only get liability based upon negligent performance of assumed duties. And then you're going to have to distinguish since the preponderance burden is on you between that and what would have occurred even if the landlord had not come into the tenancy and done something remediation negligently. How would you ever be able to prove that? You follow what I'm saying?
No, I'm afraid I don't. Let me say, obviously, let's go how it works. In a normal tenancy, the tenant sees mold in the walls. He's required by the contract and by Wörtla to report that immediately to the landlord. The landlord has knowledge. Then the landlord comes in and investigates and undertakes whatever action he's going to take. If he does nothing, then you're going to have a breach of contract unless there's fraud or concealment or some other basis.
I'm with you. But can you sue for negligence? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Isabel says no. Okay, so therefore...
Well, Isabel doesn't say no. Isabel protects all the common law claims. You would still have a violation of Wörtla, but you wouldn't have a common law claim unless you go to Section F, which I'm not going to get to, but if you go to Section F, that says you must comply with all Wörtla. If you must comply with all of Wörtla provisions, they say you must prevent the growth of mold. You must control it, so we'd have a cause of action.
But I don't know that we're communicating. I'm only asking about common law, any of the statutory schemes. And if there's mold that causes personal injury during the tenancy and the landlord does nothing during that period in violation of 20 different provisions of the lease and the statutes, etc. Am I right or wrong that there is no English common, thus no Virginia common law negligence liability?
Not that I know of. And okay. We get those cases all the time. They're usually rental homes. the landlord issues a lease agreement that says, home's yours. I'm not doing any repairs.
So,
it's yours.
So mold or no mold?
No claim.
If this statute is preempting, it's not preempting something that doesn't exist. It's only preempting something that could theoretically exist, which would be fraud, misrepresentation, and I think critical for your argument, a duty which did not originate in common law but was assumed, not by contract, but by actual action. They actually go in and start mediation and they
That's
do
right.
it wrong. Now my question is, you're out of time, I'm sorry, but how are you going to distinguish between those two scenarios if you actually get to a trial?
As to whether I have a negligent repair or whether it just occurred naturally?
A negligent repair, assumed duty, versus a non-negligent repair, non-assumed duty.
Well, you would have a common law assumption of duty if they go in and undertake repairs.
Fair enough.
If they do not, then I don't believe you're going to have any common law claim unless it is fraud, concealment, or failure to warn.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate your time.
May it please the Court. My name is George Somerville. I am counsel for the appellees. I will discuss the plaintiff's failure to preserve the arguments that he presents on appeal, and I ask the Court to dismiss the appeal. Mr. Kelly will discuss the merits and ask the Court to affirm. The purposes of preservation rules have been stated many times. They are to afford trial courts an opportunity to rule intelligently and avoid unnecessary appeals and reversals. This plaintiff did not give the trial court that opportunity. He never asked the court for a different ruling. This case has a great deal in common with the Nussbaum case, which is discussed in the briefs. In both cases, the ruling challenged on appeal was made sua sponte, and as Mr. Bailey has acknowledged, it was a surprise to everyone. In both cases, the arguments asserted on appeal were stated in endorsements to an order. The major differences in the two cases is that in Nussbaum, counsel stated his arguments in open court, but he said, I'm not asking you to rule on them, I'm just preserving them for appeal, which of course he did not. In this case, counsel never stated his arguments to the trial court, and he did not ask for a ruling in his favor.
But he had the objections to the final order, though, right?
He did.
When the judge signs the order, looking at the objections, isn't that a ruling saying I'm not going to follow the objections?
Justice Kelsey, the Nussbaum decision addressed exactly that situation. The appellant stated his due process objections in the final order, and he argued on appeal that those objections gave the court the opportunity to reconsider, to vacate that order, and change its ruling. And this court rejected that argument, and I quote from its opinion because, I quote, Nussbaum never asked the circuit court to rule on his due process objections.
And I thought that was in the context of the lawyer saying, you know, I'm just doing this for appeal, don't worry about it.
That was the factual context, but the holding of this court was that stating the objections in endorsements to an order did not preserve because he never asked the court for a ruling. That was beyond, he said to the court, I'm not asking. He did not ask. That's the problem.
Well, what he did was he affirmatively disclaimed a request to the trial court. And that was the problem, it seems to me, and it distinguishes Nussbaum from the statute itself, 8.01384, that makes it clear that recital of objections in a final order will be sufficient to preserve for assertion on appeal. But if you read Nussbaum and you read the statute's pretty clear. What is it that's unique about Nussbaum? What's unique is the lawyer stood up and said, Judge, I don't want you to do anything about it. My objections aren't for you. They're for the appellate courts. Isn't that the distinction that we make with Nussbaum?
Well, I think, with all respect, Chief Justice Lemons, it doesn't fly. Let's look at what this plaintiff said to the trial court, and this is page 109 in the appendix. I don't disrespect the court's analysis at all. However, I think the best thing to do, and I so move, if the court is willing, is to grant an interlocutory appeal. That's awfully close to what counsel said in Nussbaum. It's not identical, but substantively, I submit, it's the same.
What he's saying, counsel, is while I disagree with you, Your Honor, I respect your ruling, and I want to take it to the Supreme Court?
Yes.
So when he tells the court on page 98, when he asks the court on page 98, are you dismissing the common law negligence claim? Did the court remember to look at negligent repair? That coupled with him saying, I respectfully disagree with you, Your Honor, doesn't that preserve his claim on negligent repair?
Well, I think Nussbaum teaches this, Justice Powell, that the focus is on the argument and not on the ruling. Both judges made their ruling. But in Nussbaum, it wasn't enough because the judge was never asked to rule on the due process argument. And lest I use up all the time, I would like to yield the balance to Mr. Kelly. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Bert Kelly, along with Mr. Somerville. I represent the appellees in this matter and will address the merits of it. Again, shorten my arguments based upon the concessions of my adversary that the common law Isabel, Caudill, and its predecessors is still good law. And as it applies to the circumstances in the Cherry case, it is when a tenant goes into a dwelling unit, he accepts all of the risks associated. So in 2008, behind the Isabel decision, the Supreme Court steps in and says, I'm going to carve out an exception. It is not fair for a tenant to begin an occupancy where there is visible evidence of mold in the naked eye at the time of the move-in inspection.
You meant the General Assembly?
Yes, the General Assembly. That definition is the same in Title 55 as it at 8.1 and simply can't be ignored. So the question for the court is, was that 801.226 directly and irreconcilably in conflict with the common law? Well, the answer is clearly yes. As Justice Kelsey had pointed out, the law is clear. A landlord has no duty when the premises is the exclusive possession and control of the tenant to make any repairs.
But at common law, didn't the landlord have a duty to not make a negligent repair?
That will is a good segue into my harmless error argument. I knew the court was going to. And Justice Goodwin, who wrote the opinion in Sales versus Kickatown Housing, where I stood before you in 2010, and we had this same argument. The distinction here is the law from Tugman forward was that you must create the condition that was the proximate cause of the injury. And Mr. Bailey and I had arguments in Sales about the alleged negligent repairs that were performed by the project owner and the property manager. My argument in that case and my argument here is that the actions of the landlord and the property manager did not create the molds.
But isn't that a factual question? The question really is, did negligent remediation aggravate a pre-existing condition? It's just like a personal injury case when one tortfeasor hits the victim and the second tortfeasor hits the victim. You got liability for the second tortfeasor, the negligent assumption of the duty. But the last question I asked your opponent, I'm still trying to figure out in my own mind, I don't know how it can be proved. I mean, maybe it can be. It would take knowledge well above my pay grade, but isn't that the point, that he should be able to get an evidentiary shot at trying to prove that?
And that's with the court's ruling in Sales. Distinction in Cherry. Paragraph 7 of the complaint admits no visible evidence at move-in inspection. Paragraph 9 alleges injuries within weeks of occupancy. The molds were not discovered until months after occupancy, when a mushroom was observed growing out of the carpet in a living room, opened up the walls. Up to that point in time, there is no visible evidence of mold. Because of the visible evidence of the mushroom, the time they opened up the walls, and there's mold, a small area that was treated by the tenant. From a factual perspective and a proof perspective, Judge Kelsey, I don't know how you could prove when the tenant was exposed to the mold spores that were toxic under the circumstances.
But
maybe he can't. But he hadn't had the opportunity. Now, counsel, you are one of the best attorneys in the state. If it's so obvious that the common law was abrogated, why didn't you argue it?
I focused on the pleadings that failed to allege a common law claim, and the negligence per se failed to allege an underlying common law duty, only the violation of building and housing codes, which are statutory and not common law.
But they alleged a failure to properly remediate, did they not, counsel? And counts 3 and 4, a duty to perform with reasonable care any repairs undertaken.
I reiterate, Justice Powell, is the law in this commonwealth has been, arguably up until Sales, that unless your negligence creates the condition that causes the injury, which is not the case here, was not the case in Sales.
Well, the condition could be a little bit of spores and a lot more spores.
But did the actions of the landlord in failing to properly remediate condensate lines in the HVAC closet of Mr. Cherry's apartment create the mold conditions that was the proximate cause of his injury? Answer is no.
But wouldn't he be entitled to prove that it aggravated his condition?
I would suggest to the court that that has not been the law in this commonwealth, and you might want to consider leaving that to the legislature, because the law in this commonwealth has been pretty strict on this up until Sales.
May I ask you this? Be able to argue it? I mean, it's... I'm not going to place a bet on who's going to win if it ultimately gets to the merits. I find it just remarkable that a judge would look at a statute that other than the definitions includes only about 225 words and never indicates an intention to abrogate, and say common law is gone. This 225 word statute means that you can't even come into court.
That's back to the preemption argument, which I believe was plainly manifested, that there can be no dispute amongst counsel as to whether or not the adoption of 81-226 changed the common law. It is completely opposite.
Well, let me ask you this. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to come at it a different way. Do you believe that the common law was abrogated? I mean, they certainly added to the common law, but did it abrogate what was already there?
Only in the very narrow context of visible molds that are present at the time of the move-in inspection or occupancy.
How does it abrogate common law? How does the statute abrogate common law?
Because there was no duty prior to the adoption of 8.01.226.12 for a landlord.
So it creates a new duty. It creates a new duty, but that's not abrogating the common law. It's adding to it.
A landlord, and under no circumstances a property manager with maintenance responsibilities, had any duty prior to 8.01.226.12 to remediate mold conditions that arise during the course of a tenancy.
So unless they assume it. That's the whole point. Under common law, if you assume a duty that you don't otherwise have, you got to do it right.
Justice Kelsey, I'm addressing the preemption argument. I think when the statute occupies a narrow field and changes the common law, then it abrogates the common law, but only to the extent of those duties that they had prior to the adoption of that statute. All the remedies are still available. I mean, Mr. Cherry has not left remedy-less. He may not have personal injury claims, but he has claims.
Right, and let me follow up on that, if I may, because your opposing counsel pointed out, you know, the default at common law is the tenant wants something fixed, you go out and fix it. He says, well, this contract, though, said you can't make repairs, tenants, because, look, this is our property, we're the landlord, and you might fix it wrong, you might have substandard grade materials, whatever. We're going to fix it, we're the landlord. So practically speaking, when the tenant with this kind of lease, which I think is a pretty standard clause, says, don't fix it, it's on us, landlord, to fix it, what is the tenant to do in this situation? Contact the landlord, and then what?
Enforce the rights and obligations under the VRLTA, which is to keep the premises fit and habitable.
So in other words, I'm not trying to extort any kind of concession. I'm just trying to figure out how this works practically. So the tenant, the landlord does nothing. Can they withhold rent? Can they move out? What do they do? If the landlord is non-responsive or responsive in this haphazard way?
If the landlord is not responsive for BRLTA, you have your traditional contract remedies, and that's it.
Okay.
A practical implication, which Justice Lemons and Justice Goodwin may remember when I addressed the court in sales, is what happens when mold grows and it's in the exclusive possession of the tenant? What advice does an attorney give to his landlord or property manager? Don't touch it. Don't touch it.
But they did touch it.
They did. They remedied the condensate line leaks in the HVAC line.
And they took out the floorboard and found mold behind the wall, and they put something on that that wasn't approved to create, take care of the problem. So they did more than the condensate line, I think.
Well, I again suggest to the court, based upon the complaint that was filed, Mr. Cherry says he becomes ill within weeks. It's months before the mushroom is observed and the wall is opened up, and it's an issue of evidence and proof. But when those molds accumulated, it would be hard to prove in my book. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, you are out of time. Madam Clerk, please call the next two cases, and both cases will be heard one right after the other. They are related cases, however, so counsel can come to counsel table. Call both cases.